This programming is sponsored by Linscombe Wealth, a wealth management firm partnering with individuals and families dedicated to helping them build, preserve, and manage wealth by creating a customized plan to work toward achieving their goals. More at linscombewealth.com.
Welcome to this week's Party Politics. I'm Jay Iyer, a political science professor from Texas Southern University.
And I'm Brandon Ruttinghouse, a political science professor from the University of Houston. Thanks for joining Jay and I to talk about politics. And although we've been off for a week for spring break, we've got a lot of things that have happened, Jay. So let's start off the top with a new war on opioids.
That's right. It's a war on drugs, take two, except this time it's really
personal.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Sorry, I had to
this
slip
time
that in.
Well, in a matter of speaking, it is, because the argument is this has been a war that's been declared on opioids, prescription drugs primarily, and essentially it's reached epidemic levels, particularly along sort of the Northeast and the Midwest parts of the country, and it's created massive amounts of problems, not just for in terms of human tragedy, but for law enforcement and all other instances. The interesting thing to me is a radically different approach is being proposed. This is much more of a treatment-based approach. President Trump gave a big speech where he laid out reforms to allowing Medicaid enrollees having easier access to addiction treatment, raising standards for how prescriptions are going to be written, expanding the availability of a drug called naloxone, which is the antidote for overdoses, and making sure it gets distributed to policing entities, and just a much greater sort of awareness. I say that, but Back to the Future occurred in this speech as well. Death penalty for drug dealers.
Right. This was, I thought, certainly him tackling a hot issue of the day, and clearly he's made it emotional and he definitely cares, but it may be that he's kind of overshot the runway on this one, right? I don't know that that's going to be something that's going to be workable, but it clearly shows he cares about it and is willing to really take it on. So if it's just rhetoric, that's one thing, but following through with this, I think, would mean something quite else. But I think you're exactly right. This is a multi-pronged approach that people have been waiting for. Congress had already appropriated $6 billion to combat the opioid epidemic, and this is another way to be able to reinforce some of those things. My take is that it's generally sad, but a rhetorical war on domestic issues rarely outlasts the rhetoric of the president. To be able to sustain itself, it needs to have two things. One is a moral voice from the president, and the second is common sense solutions. So I think that the common sense solutions are there. The question is whether or not the president will have the moral voice to keep up this effort.
Yeah, I thought his proposal was kind of classic Trumpian, right? Mm-hmm. You have probably three quarters of it that was policy driven, developed by public health officials out of the CDC and the health department, and really came up with, I think, some positive solutions that we can all agree on. And then he threw in a little red meat rhetoric, sort of his visceral reaction, which is, let's kind of kill them, not really being clear as far as defining who we're going to kill, since the cause of the opioid epidemic, in many cases, are drug manufacturers, some cases overprescription by certain physicians. I can't imagine he's actually suggesting that we kill them. He has actually laid out, and it all comes back to China, he's talked about the production of synthetic opioids in China that are being imported into the United States, and he's trying to put pressure on the Chinese government to act as well. Speaking of the way the president's been acting, he made a pretty pronounced decision in indirectly, I guess, asking Jeff Sessions, the attorney general, to fire someone. Brandon, what happened?
Yeah, so the attorney general, as you mentioned, Jeff Sessions, has fired former FBI deputy director Andrew McCabe. This was less than 2 days before his retirement, where he would get full benefits. The argument was that the FBI internally had found that the deputy director had violated some specific policies that were not released. One of which, though, was certainly something that wrangled the rest of the White House, and that was that he had told information publicly to the Wall Street Journal about a particular investigation. The general swirl of controversy is about his handling of the Clinton email controversy during the campaign and how forthcoming he was with Congress about these issues. So the administration says this is about facts. This is about what violations occurred. McCabe and supporters shot back and said that this is all politics, that basically McCabe is somebody who has information about this ongoing investigation with the Russian investigation or with the Russian involvement in the election, and that this was political retribution or pre-retribution. I don't know how you would sort of classify this, but it's certainly become a longstanding, another sort of element in a longstanding problem that the White House has faced about this issue.
Yeah, I think the 2 days issue is one that just made it look mean-spirited. Mm-hmm. And that's been, I think, the big criticism. It's 2 days before his retirement. He had already indicated or planned on retiring regardless. This was sort of a way to prevent him from collecting his pension, which just seemed unbelievably petty on the part of the president. I think he needed to stay employed through Monday, and he was fired on a Friday.
Right.
I mean, it's something crazy like that. But I think the larger politics of it seems clearly tied to trying to undermine the merits of the Mueller investigation. This comes really on the heels of the GOP House committee, at least the GOP members of the House committee, investigating the Russia scandal, mm-hmm. making a conclusion that there was no direct collusion. This is also coming on the heels of sort of a larger question where the president himself is sort of saying he was vindicated through this process to try to kind of undermine the investigation as a whole that Mueller's putting out. We know that Andrew McCabe was going to be testifying to that effect or in that process. So I think this is just a means to that. I'm not sure it's being interpreted as anything more than that.
Yeah. There's discussion that McCabe has internal documents that he's collected and that he's put on paper that have implied conversations with the president that might back up what James Comey had to say. So this is another witness who could potentially be seriously difficult for the
president. And Brandon, this is an important thing. The same issue happened with James Comey. Mm-hmm. You're fully aware FBI agents are known to take notes, contemporaneous notes, right?
Just assume it's happening, right?
Assume it's happening, right? And so Andrew McCabe made contemporaneous notes to conversations that he had. He said the president of the United States frequently during meetings would reference political related things. He wanted to know if he voted for him. So, I mean, it just seems like he should have been aware of some of this. But, you know, sometimes a president, I think, clearly can't help himself. Well, Brandon, we've got another deadline approaching. Exactly. I thought we just went through this. I thought the problem was solved. What happened?
Right. Well, we have yet another in a series of high-stakes negotiations between Congress and the president and also within Congress to pass a budget, which is essentially in process. Now, full disclosure, we record this before the end of the week, and so we don't know exactly what will happen. But we do know that they're close to a deal, which includes a whole bunch of stuff. Not everybody is a winner here, though, Jay. We've got winners and losers. So what's your take on what the current situation looks like?
Well, as our listeners will probably recall, a few weeks ago, as the deadline was approaching, much to the surprise of many people, a multi-year budget framework was passed. And so what it set up for is sort of spending guidelines, spending limitations. It increased domestic spending. It increased military spending, provided a certain level of certainty, but it was a budget framework. This is the actual budget itself that has to be ratified, has to be passed. So in it, there are some interesting provisions. There's the issue right now isn't so much the base budget, because we've already talked about the fact that it increases spending, which has caused some real problems for members of the Freedom Caucus, many conservatives, particularly following the massive tax cut that we just saw. But issues like adding on issues related to infrastructure spending in some areas, we're back to the special interest. We've seen add-ons put into it. Senator Cornyn's bill, the National Instant Criminal Background Check System, the NICS system to allow and add in more individuals onto that list to try to prevent it, sort of in the wake of the Parkland tragedy. And so we've got that. There's still some question about whether DACA or some sort of immigration deal will be tacked onto this. So we've got all these other questions, but it's these sidebar questions that are being dealt with and whether it all gets put in. Brandon, I'm curious what you think. How much do you think what happened in Pennsylvania and the impending midterm elections come into play? Because this might be the last significant piece of legislation that's even up this cycle.
Yeah, I think it could have some pretty serious effects. I mean, for one, you know, I think the president has to be able to explain to his supporters why he didn't get the full money for the wall, about $1.6 billion was allocated and the president was asking for $25 billion. So I would call him in this the big loser. Not only the fact that he didn't get that, but also the fact that Congress really negotiated much of this on their own without him. So if they can operate without the president, then they make the White House irrelevant. And that makes it harder for him to make a compelling case for why he should get reelected. I think bipartisanship, though, really shined in a couple of these. We saw the opioid discussion from earlier. I think part of this, they're going to spend more money on that. They're also going to spend money for low-income house credit, tax credits. So there was definitely negotiation on the spending more money on for troops as well as for defense. So there was a lot of things here that both parties can be pleased with. And I think that probably reflects the fact that they're a little bit worried about what the election will look like. So winners and losers here. But at the end of the day, I think President Trump really, despite the fact that he objected to it, didn't shine in this.
Yeah. And I think and the ultimate big loser in this is anybody who is opposed to a really large budget deficit.
Right.
Because
right.
Because what we're at historic levels. We've been there for a while. But any idea that or any myth that conservative government will somehow reduce the size of the federal government, this should dispel that rumor.
Well, Jay, on a lighter side, we're coming up on Easter, and we've got an interesting character here who's become a bit of a political fluff, I guess you could say. Marlon Bundo. Who's Marlon Bundo?
Marlon Bundo is the amazingly, wonderfully named bunny. The Vice President of the United States, Mike Pence, has a bunny named Marlon Bundo, and his daughter decided to write a children's book about it. His wife is a wonderful illustrator, illustrated the book. It looks very nice. It's done really well. It's out, but it's not the only Marlon Bundo book on the market. Political satirist John Oliver, who himself has a book out on Marlon Bundo, except this Marlon Bundo, the story is a little bit different, Brandon.
It is. So in this case, Marlon Bundo is gay and has different relationships with other bunnies and gets married in the book, which is a not-so-subtle jab at Mike Pence and his fairly rigid views about homosexuality.
Right. And it's important to know that Oliver's book, which is, in fact, written by Marlon Bundo, as he says, by the pen name Marlon Bundo.
Right.
All the money for it is going to charitable causes. And I'm not sure, I assume actually Vice President Pence's book is as well.
It does. Both do.
Right, both do. So it's a good cause for both. Two great bunnies, depending on your perspective, I guess.
Right. Well, and it's good. You know, controversy sells and the sales help charities, and that's what it's all about.
Yeah, and in the world we live in today, with the issues that we're dealing with, if the biggest thing we're talking about is Marlon Bundo, then something's going right.
Well, our producer's going to cut this out, but I had a bunny, Jay, growing up, actually. And Marlon Bundo is a much better name than the name of the bunny that I had.
What was, I've got an ask
you, now. You have one guess, and it's the most obvious bunny name. Think Bambi.
Is it?
Thumper.
Really?
Yes. In my defense, at the time, I was young. I was third grade. The bunnies were our class pet, and they came home with us. So, yes, my childhood featured a bunny, and that's why I'm so well-adjusted right now.
Indeed. Never knew you and Mike Pence had so much in
that's
common.
That's how much you have in common, yeah.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we are going to take a deep look into the story, maybe of the next few weeks, Brandon, and that is what's going on with this Cambridge Analytics scandal.
So, Jay, set your relationship status to scandal. Facebook and Cambridge Analytica, which is a data firm that was hired by President Trump's 2016 election campaign, had apparently gained access to information from about 50 million Facebook users. The question is, what is Facebook going to do about it, if anything? What is the federal government going to do about it, if with anything? And what does it all mean?
Well, all right, let's take them one at a time. What is Facebook going to do about it? Probably not much. So part of the issue here is that Facebook, their fundamental business model is dealing with your personal data.
Right.
That's how they make their money. You have the opportunity to use this platform to connect with people, share your ideas, your interests.
And my breakfast cereal, right?
Exactly. What you ate today, what you ate yesterday, and lots of pictures of yourself, right? That's all valuable information that everyone in the world must know. But it also tells you also things you like, dislike, all of these characteristics. It's as if there's a little miniature version of you and all your all your preferences. And that's really the fundamental basis here. So that information will always be there. And that information is valuable for them. That's how they make the money. They don't really make it on advertising in the same way. Congress and government as a whole, I think, the FTC is weighing in. Facebook had signed a consent decree and that essentially had said that they were aware that some people were illegally accessing some of their data and sharing it around.
Well, it's illegal in the sense that they weren't supposed to use it for profit, right?
Correct.
And that's why people purposefully allowed Facebook to access this stuff. People took these quizzes and they put all their information
exactly
out there, right?
Right, but you're not supposed to be able to access data that when you didn't opt into the quiz. So the opt-in share is one thing. But for example, if I took one of those personality quizzes mm-hmm. and said, oh, things I like and dislike.
Are you a Carrie? Are you a Miranda?
Exactly.
Where do you fit?
Exactly.
Are you Jerry? Are you Elaine? Right?
Right. Just like that. Except here is you could get my data and my information because I've opted in, but also all of the tens of thousands of friends that I have. Yes, I do have thousands of friends.
I count
on
myself
Facebook,
as one of them.
Including you. So then they get access to all of your information. And that's where they get in trouble.
Yeah.
Because they're not supposed to have access to your information. What made it even worse was Facebook was aware of this practice. And what took it even to the next level is the individual that did it actually sold it to Cambridge Analytica. So that chain of events is what the issue is. They signed a decree saying they would be fined $50,000 per offense. Well, we've got 50 million people. So the real question is whether or not the FTC is going to actually enforce that.
Yeah. And the political angle here is that this firm was funded by Robert Mercer, who is a wealthy Republican donor and also has connections to Steve Bannon, who is a former advisor to the president, who is an early board member. So this is definitely a political conundrum for the White House. But I think it also speaks to kind of bigger issues with respect to how campaigns are run now, right? Now it's all about micro-targeting, right? Trying to find an edge. Campaigns are looking for a way to be able to communicate directly to you. There's something that's, I think, good about that, right? Trying to tailor a message to a person because that's what democracy is supposed to be about. And yet, when it goes this far, the question is it too far? I don't know exactly whether or not I think that this is wrong. People are willing to share this information. And so I don't know that it shouldn't be something that Facebook allows or that is somehow viewed as negative. We are victims of our own narcissism. And I think that this is really a full impact of exactly what happened there.
Well, let's take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to tell you why this scandal means so much.
So, Jay, we've run down a couple of the problems that have resulted from this Cambridge Analytica scandal. What does it mean to people, and why should we care about it?
There's a little bit of irony in that people are complaining about their privacy when they're upset that, you know, the number of times they've eaten at McDonald's is posted on Facebook
right,
for them,
right?
So, but at the same token, they have a right to a certain expectation that the data that they are putting out there is limited to the audiences that they want. What I think is problematic is the idea that not just your information, but anyone you're connected with, their information becomes public as well. It's not supposed to work that way. There's supposed to be some sort of wall around your privacy. But it's hard, right? Because as you were talking about, you want to be able to target information to them. That's the whole premise behind Facebook and the algorithms that are used. If I say I like Cheetos, maybe they'll start sending me advertisements for other kinds of products similar to Cheetos.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way it's supposed to work.
Yeah.
But in politics, it creates the opposite effect, where you can get a situation where you're only getting one perspective. And we've talked about this before. You get that perspective where you're in a silo, you're in a bubble of information. You don't hear divergent views, and as a consequence, our politics becomes corroded, more partisan, more focused.
This certainly contributes to that. There's no doubt. I think part of the reason, too, is that Facebook continues to change the process. They continue to change the rules. And so although some of this was allowed at the time, it's no longer allowed. So the shifting rules, I think, create some complications. And Mark Zuckerberg has apologized for this kind of breach of trust. But I don't know that it isn't something that's going to continue in other ways, right? Maybe it's not Facebook. Maybe it's Instagram. Maybe it's Twitter. Maybe there's some other ways that you can purchase information, not necessarily about you, but about something that's similar to you, the type of person you are, the things you like to eat, the places you go. So these are all things that are used as data points to allow for these campaigns to be able to try to market something directly to you. Some days it's going to be soap, some days it's going to be cigar, some days it's going to be a candidate. And so I don't know that this is something which is going to go away, even if it's the case that some of this was on the border of being seriously problematic.
Well, that's a wrap for this week. Remember, we do a weekly Texas Politics episode 2, which you can download on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Party Politics is recorded in the George B. Geary Performance Studio at Houston Public Media.
Thanks to our ever-patient producer, Edel Howland, who would never swipe our personal information, and to our engineer, Todd Zuckerberg-Holslander.
I'm Jay Iyer.
And I'm Brandon Rodinghouse. We'll see you next week.